that go okay? Yeah, okay, that was straightforward.
Do you want us to bring books like every day?
Definitely, you'll probably want to bring a reader since we're going to be talking about that. There's some useful stuff, some of the images that are in the textbook that I'll talk about a little bit today just so we can all be looking at the same thing. So if it's convenient, I mean, I know that this is a particularly heavy book, so, you know, if it's not convenient, don't bring it, but it may come in handy at times. So. Other questions about just the logistics of the business of the class? Anything stand? No. Okay. Today, actually, one other thing. Yesterday I said I would bring my DSM-IV. This is the large, it's pretty incredible. It's the large American Psychiatric Association's effort to take all psychological disorders and put them in a big book with diagnostic criteria. And so I'm just going to send this around and look through it as we talk today. When you first get one of these, you just want to look up everybody you know and see if you can locate friends and family. So go right ahead. All right, today we're going to talk about assessment and diagnosis. And this is inevitably placed at the beginning of this course, which is sort of a weird place for it because we haven't talked about what we're assessing and what we're diagnosing. You know, we don't have the disorders in hand to be working with. But it comes to make sense in the end. It's sort of a weird way to go ahead and start with assessment and diagnosis. And basically, the issue around assessment and diagnosis is how do we, when confronted with a new person or a new potential patient, how do we start to understand what's going on with them, what their dynamics are, what the best kind of treatment is going to be, what's going to be most effective in trying to help them? And there's lots and lots of different ways to do this. Most times it happens in the context of a clinical interview, that a patient comes to therapy, they're looking for help, and the beginning of therapy is really about sitting down with the person and trying to get a sense of what's going on in their lives and why they've chosen to come for psychological help. Usually when I do this, I start very open-ended. I sort of say, so, you felt like it would be helpful to come and talk. What's going on? And try to open it up in that way. But there are several things that it's really helpful to always try to get a grip on in just an interview process. Usually, my what's going on question is a question about what are your symptoms, what's bringing you in, what's upsetting to you. And in that, I always try to find out from people, is this something that just started? Is this something that's been going on for 6 years and you've decided now that you want to come start to talk to somebody about it or you want to get some help with it? How bad is it? So if people say, I've been really down, I say, down, what is down? What kind of down? And if they say, so down that I'm not going to my job, that's one thing. If they say, so down that I often find when I'm home by myself I cry, that's another thing. You try to get sort of a grip on the severity of what they're talking about. One question that's always really critical in trying to make a diagnosis is why now? Why is this person coming now for help? Or is there something that recently happened? It can be very easy to sort of fall into, hearing all about the symptoms and never say, was there something that happened that you think is maybe, causing you to feel more down? And often people don't even make the connection themselves. And inevitably, it seems like you hear something like, oh, well, actually, yes, the woman I had been dating dumped me very precipitously 3 weeks ago. And I guess, that's sort of funny. Now that you mention it, ever since then, I've been feeling extremely down. So it's helpful to try to help make a connection about why the person is coming for help at the time they're coming. Usually you want to ask about, sort of start with really basic stuff about their physical functioning, that it's easy to sort of get drawn into the psychological functioning because that, it's very interesting and inherently complicated. But it's also really important when you're in the process of trying to make an assessment of what kind of treatment is going to be effective to find out, are you sleeping? Are you eating? Are you able to, do you have the energy that you usually have? And to find out those kinds of things. Partially, this can help you rule out another diagnostic possibility. People who have thyroid conditions, thyroid is it's a gland that emits all sorts of really important hormones. If your thyroid is severely out of whack, it has all the exact same symptoms of depression. It looks exactly like depression. And so what you also want to avoid is, going this whole thing, deciding this person is definitely depressed, it makes all sorts of sense, they got a B on a paper they thought they were going to get an A on, and then miss something like a thyroid diagnosis. So it's really important to get a grip on the physical condition. One of the things that is very easy to forget to ask about, especially when you are confronted with a person who is clean cut, looks good, very pulled together, very articulate, is to ask about drug and alcohol abuse. And this is something that I always try to, you know, make myself ask about and get out in the first session, because once you don't ask about it, it can be sometimes very hard to bring up later. And this is a really tricky issue when it comes to doing assessments, because people are often, if they are drinking a lot or doing drugs, it's usually not the thing they want to tell you first, right? People often feel quite uncomfortable about even coming to talk to a psychologist about something going on. And so then to fess up to, you know, drinking a fair bit or taking drugs as a way to try to manage what's going on in their lives isn't something they're inclined to do. To some degree, this means that psychologists have a rule of thumb that if the person says, yes, I drink, and you say, you know, how much do you drink? And they say, oh, 2 or 3 beers a night. You think, okay, that's 6 or 7 beers a night. You know, you sort of do the, you've got a multiplier in your head. It's important to be specific. I remember when I was beginning my training, I met with a young man who was very, very depressed and who was feeling suicidal, and, you know, was having our interview, and I asked, you know, about family history and things that had happened in his past, and it turns out his dad had, in fact, committed suicide when this young man was in high school. And, you know, clean cut, on his way to law school, very articulate guy, and I said, you know, how about drinking, you know, do you drink? And he said, yeah, I drink a little, you know, and I said, a little, you know, because it's very important to be specific. And he said, I usually have 6 to 12 beers a night, and then on the weekends I really drink. And I said, oh, okay, you know, and then that totally changes the scope of what we're talking about and totally changes the focus of what needs to be addressed first. Let me take actually a quick move away from sort of the central thing of assessment. One of the things that psychologists have really found about why it's so important to get a grip on the drug and alcohol stuff early in trying to treat somebody is that you actually cannot be very helpful psychologically to somebody who is using substances a lot. That it really, using substances and trying to get help in a psychological manner are completely at cross purposes. That, you know, psychological help is about trying to understand hard feelings, understand what's going on, get to the bottom of things. And drugs and alcohol, when used to treat bad feelings, are all about trying to numb bad feelings, avoid bad feelings, get away from those. And so the two really don't go together very well. And for a long time, psychologists would say to people, well, it sounds like you've got, you know, a pretty serious drinking problem, or a pretty serious drug problem, or, you know, there's no question that you're an alcoholic, but why don't you and I start talking, and that'll go away once we figure out what the problem is. And after doing this for about 50 or 60 years, psychologists have finally come to the conclusion that it doesn't work, and that people would be in therapy for 6, 7, 8 years, and every once in a while the therapist would say, so, how's the drinking? And usually the patients say, oh, same as it ever was, and it really gets in the way of any progress. Increasingly, when psychologists find out that there's a real drug or alcohol problem, the thing that I have come to say is to the person, you know, look, it sounds like you're really, you know, using substances a fair bit. And my experience is that no matter how hard you try in here, it's not going to be so helpful to you to be in therapy while you're drinking or doing a lot of drugs. And then I'll say, let's do this. Why don't you stop for a couple of weeks and see how that feels? And we'll keep meeting. And let me know how it goes with the stopping. You know, maybe something you can do comfortably may not be something you can do so comfortably. Let's keep talking about that. And I sort of make a contract with them, because for some people it turns out that they can stop cold turkey, that, you know, it's something that's very contextual, not a big deal. They've been, you know, drinking or doing a lot of drugs, but they can just stop when they want. For other people, they say, yeah, no problem, absolutely, I'll stop for a couple of weeks. And you check in with them a week later and you say, you know, so how's the stopping going? And they say, oh, you know, it's actually not going so well. I really intended to stop, I'm not stopping. And that actually then gives the psychologist a nice opening to say, you know, maybe that's the first problem. You know, if you're wanting to stop and you can't stop, I think that's a good hint to us that let's address that first, and then we'll get back to this other stuff. So that's how increasingly psychologists try to manage that. Okay, moving on to history of psychological disorders. I always ask people, you know, is this the first time you've been to a therapist? Have you ever been in therapy before? Have you ever sought psychological help before? And this is a good hint if there's sort of a pattern of problems. You know, if a person says, yeah, actually, every 3 years I drop into these massive depressions. You know, I've tried this, I've tried that. That's a good hint that this person maybe has a biological depression that gets kicked up from time to time, or some sort of periodic disorder. It's very important to ask about family history and also family history of psychological disorders, especially if you're talking about some of the disorders that have a more medical, genetic, biological basis, like depression, like anxiety. It can really be helpful to make a diagnosis on that. I have in therapy a very interesting 17-year-old girl who has some psychotic functioning, which in a 17-year-old is extremely concerning because usually psychotic functioning isn't something that starts until people are in their mid-20s. And it's very sort of hard to know where this is going to go with her and what, you know, her long-term prognosis is. But one of the questions I was sure to ask her parents was, you know, has anybody else in your family had, you know, trouble with their thinking, trouble with knowing what's real and not real? And the mom said, yeah, we have a crazy aunt. You know, she's always been crazy. She does all of this really weird stuff. And mom went on to describe a fairly extensive picture of very, very paranoid behavior, very, very, you know, she would, you know, come up with really crazy accusations and level them at people in the family. And, you know, she would decide one day that her kids could no longer play with any kids in the neighborhood and just had these very sort of unusual behaviors. And that was helpful for me in trying to figure out what was going on with this adolescent to think, okay, there's a good reason to think there's a genetic strain here of some sort of psychotic functioning. In terms of that young woman, we now have her on antipsychotics, and she's doing a lot of therapy, and she's looking better, but it's hard to know where it's going to go with her. In addition to family history of psychological disorders, I also just like to ask about family history. And I usually sort of say, you know, tell me about your family, and tell me what it was like growing up. And this can obviously be very helpful in terms of getting people to describe their situation, that if there are divorces or deaths or intense interpersonal experiences in the family that may impact the current experience, it's really helpful to know. Finally, you kind of want to assess intellectual and cognitive functioning. Usually you can do this as you're talking, you know? I mean, it's not that hard sometimes to tell, you know, roughly where a person stands in their sort of intellectual functioning just by how they talk, how they interact, their memory, their ability to stick with one topic and stay on it. This can begin to become an issue if you suspect that there may be something like a slight retardation or a learning disability. So it's something that when you start talking about cognitive disorders, and we'll spend a whole section on that, disorders like dementia or delirium, that you'll do a more thorough assessment of intellectual and cognitive functioning. For most psychological disorders, it's really not that critical. Those are sort of the question parts of doing assessment. There's also a very much more subtle part of doing an assessment that is harder to describe but ends up, I think, in some ways being one of the most critical parts of assessment, which is what it feels like to be with the person, that a lot of times you can get a sense of somebody's experience by really tuning into your own experience of being with them. So let me give you a couple of examples. Sometimes if you are assessing somebody who is extremely depressed, it is one of the most depressing situations you've ever been in, that they are really lethargic, they talk really slow, they communicate this, you know, in their body language, they're slumping, they don't look good. If you ask them, you know, is there anything that you feel is going well in your life right now, they say, no. You know, and by the end of about 45 minutes of that, you're ready to, like, walk out, you know, go home for the day, go back to bed. And that's actually a very powerful assessment tool, that sort of, wow, you know, before I met with that person, I was feeling fine, I was, you know, energetic, and the experience of being with them, you know, this is clearly a very depressed person, they, you know, there's no question that that is there. I'm going to show you an interview in a little bit of a man who's quite depressed, and it's funny because there's a little bit of a split between, he's pretty talkative, he's able to talk, and yet, I bet as you watch it, if you tune into yourself, you will feel yourself sort of slipping into more and more of a funk as you listen to him. And that is actually a really good way to get a grip on what's going on with somebody else. And another person I assessed, this is probably the highest level I'd ever had of really being affected by a person, which was a woman who had borderline personality disorder, which we will get to. And basically that is a personality disorder where boundaries are not well in place. People are can be at times extremely disorganized and have a lot of trouble in relationships, a lot of trouble maintaining boundaries in relationships. And this woman, on top of that, was having an extremely hard time. She was very disorganized in her life, didn't function particularly well. And so the very first time I met her, I went out to the waiting room to get her, and I brought her into my office, and she had with her a bunch of saltines, and you know how like a saltine wrapper like you take out of the cardboard box? She had that, and it was open, and she had a big Coke without a lid on it and a straw. And so she comes into my office, you know, and just there's stuff all over immediately. There's crumbs all over. And she says, "Do you want some? Do you want some? Want a cracker?" And I said, "No, no, why don't you come on, sit down?" And she's like, "Okay, do you mind if I eat?" And I said, "No, no, no, that's fine." So I have a little table in my office, and so she sets up her whole thing. I mean, and I have just met this woman. And she proceeds to eat the saltines, and I mean, there's saltine stuff everywhere in my office in about 5 minutes. And so I'm trying to give, you know, I'm like, "What's going on? Yeah, how can I help you?" And she could not keep track of my questions at all. I mean, she really was all over the place. And, you know, I said, "Is there anything in particular that's bringing you in now?" And she said, "Yeah, you know, I've had this relationship." And she goes on to describe this relationship. But then suddenly, it turns out she's not describing the relationship she started out describing. She's now describing the relationship from 3 years ago. And they all kind of blended together in the way she was talking about it. And so, I've got this set of questions I want to ask her. And it's really clear to me there's no way I'm going to get through these questions. And even whatever I get, I'm going to have to really sort out later. It was the end of our time together, and I could tell this was going to be a problem too. The getting her out of the office was going to be an issue. And so about 5 minutes before it's time to stop, I say, "We have about 5 minutes until it's time for us to stop. So let me just ask you a couple more questions and then we'll wrap up." You know, so trying to prime her for this. So then, you know, that is a disaster. You know, she talks and talks and talks and talks. And I say, "Okay, you know, well, it's time for us to stop. You know, would you like to come back?" And she doesn't answer that question, but goes back to something else she was talking about. It finally comes to the point where I actually have to stand up, right? In order for us to leave the office, I have to stand up and say, "Okay, you know, let's find another time to meet." And so finally, that worked, and she left. And in the next half hour, I proceeded to lose my keys, left my bag somewhere, started 4 projects that I did not finish, and I realized that I had completely absorbed the experience of what this woman's life is like. This extremely disjointed, confused, having a hard time, you know, keeping boundaries separate, starting and finishing something. And I thought, wow, you know, I, you know, in a half an hour picked up, you know, in the 45 minutes together, you know, picked that up. And I think I just got a tiny glimpse into what her life feels like for her all the time, and much worse than what this last half hour felt like for me. So those are the kinds of things that can be really helpful. There can also be more other interpersonal interaction stuff that happens, like sometimes you meet with somebody and they absolutely give you the worst creeps you've ever had in your whole life, and you can't quite put your finger on it, but you leave thinking, "Gosh, I wish that person doesn't have find my number," you know, that, and that's something to respond to, you know, that it doesn't happen that often, and when it happens, you have to listen to that, and you have to think, okay, what was going on in that interaction that I feel really creeped out about having met with that person? Another thing that can sometimes happen is that people can be very critical of me. You know, that they'll say, "Now, you have a PhD, do you have a PhD?" And I'll say, "Yeah." And they say, "Now, where'd you get your PhD?" I'll say, "You know, I got it at University of Michigan." "How about college? Where'd you go to college?" And they'll turn it into a grilling session of my credentials. And usually I'll say something like, "It sounds like you have a lot of questions about my credentials." And try to get it back to them and what that's about. But then, you know, that's a good hint. You know, either this person's feeling anxious about my abilities to help them, or they're feeling, you know, or maybe it's somebody who's very narcissistic and they only want to be with the best therapist in the whole wide world, you know, and that those are things that you can start to take in early. Okay, so that's sort of the fun part of doing diagnosis, or all that kind of detective work involved. Let me show you an interview, and this one is a more semi-structured interview, and it's a man being interviewed who is depressed, and he's being interviewed with a not quite as free form as what I'm describing here, but the interviewer sort of follows up questions. And so, if you can do this all the way from here, see what you think.
But you were structured. but it also allows for unstructured, open-ended questions at certain points. Over the course of the assessment interview, the man reveals a number of emotional, motivational, cognitive, and physical symptoms, along with information about the history, recurrences, and triggers of his depression. You've had this before, haven't you? I learned how it's like this. Only the first time I had it. Oh, the first time I had it in front of this before is about 14 years ago. 15? Yes, 15 years ago. That's maybe 1971. 72. 72, and yes. Okay. The first attack was in 1972. And how long did that last? That sounded like about 8 months. 8 months. And you got over it completely? Not completely. I was always very easily depressed, but there was no occasion to get me very depressed. And then about 3 years ago, I belonged to a union, and to me that was my life, but you know, my job, I was in the clothing industry, and my union was promising me a pension, and I was retired. I also had life insurance, I had medical insurance, and I was making pretty good salary, making like $12.95 an hour. This was 3 years ago, yeah. So then all of a sudden I got mugged and ended up in the hospital. I lost my job. The union wanted me to go back to work for $6.50 an hour. And through the discussions of everything, I lost my job completely and I no longer a member of the union. So I lost everything. And I no security whatsoever. And I know I'm getting older, and that's terrifying. And you've never really been back to normal since then, in your own self? Am I right? For a very short time.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Charlene Scott was, you know, I was going to the Long Beach Clinic.
Yeah.
And while I was under the medication, the program, Charlene Scott, I felt that I was regaining a lot of confidence in myself.
When was this?
It's a little bit over a year ago. And I started feeling quite normal.
What's your chief trouble at the moment?
It is very depressed and I cannot see any...
How depressed are you?
Well, I don't have enough self-confidence to go out and look for a job because I cannot face being turned down. And that's basically, and I'm afraid that I'm going to end up being a street person because I don't have any income. And I don't have any savings account. I don't have anything in the bank. I don't have anything. And I'm really terrified. And I see it happening every day. People are on the street. And more and more. And then we hear in the news that there's less people on unemployment this year than last year. That's because now they live in the streets. Don't have anything to live on.
Well, But you did get over your first attack after 8 months, didn't you?
Yes.
And jump back to normal?
But I was still back in my union and I still have fun there.
You don't think that you're going to jump back to normal again?
I don't think
so. You don't think so. And may I ask you how depressed you feel? Well, by that I mean, how blue are you? How low-spirited are you? Do you ever find yourself bursting into tears?
It would probably help if I could.
But you can't.
No.
Have you ever found yourself weeping till you're so low?
No.
Never. But you'd like to if you could.
Yes.
I see. And you feel it when they're being hopeless. Do you ever get the feeling that you'll never get well?
Yes, I get that feeling at times.
What else besides this depression? What else is wrong with you?
I don't feel that there's anybody that cares for me.
Well, that'll be the same. How do you sleep?
Not too well. I sleep maybe an hour and I'll be awake for about an hour at a time. I don't sleep a full night.
You keep waking during the night, yeah? You? How long does it take to get to sleep?
I usually watch television to sleep. You know, like try to watch something, try to get interested in something that's not interesting.
Do you have any difficulty in getting interested in anything? You do?
Yes, I do.
Not interested much in anything, are you?
No.
I see. And how are you in other ways?
Like what?
Well, how's your health in general?
It's starting to fall apart.
Do what?
It's starting to, it always was very, very, up to recently, my health physically was very well.
Regularly. But now?
Now I'm starting to feel, hard to digest my food. I don't know if it's from my training, from when I was a child, you know, but we were never free to express ourselves. You know, we were always supposed to be the well-behaved children, you know, and never to put our problems on somebody else's shoulders. But I have like a panic inside, okay, and I go out there and look at people and I can even put a smile on my face, but I'm terrified.
Terrified of what?
Because I'm not even surviving.
What do you mean by that?
To me, survival is to have money to pay your rent. And to buy food doesn't have to be anymore. But when that is missing in life, there's no survival there.
Talking about survival, I really wish to do a day.
Yeah. But I don't want to die starvation. Forever. If I could die instantly, I would probably take that. Because then I would have to live this horror.
Have you ever thought of this way yourself?
Yes.
When was the last time?
Very.
What about your energy? You tired easily?
Mm-hmm.
You get tired all the time?
Most of the time.
You ever blame yourself for the state you're in?
Well, I have nobody else to blame, and that's why I'm the only one that can find the answer. I know that.
Why do you say you have nobody else to blame? You could always blame the person who liked you. You could always blame the trouble that started 4 years ago. Trouble started 8 years. 14 years ago, you'd really bring that, couldn't you? You don't.
No, I don't.
Can you guys feel that? I mean, he's talking, and he answers questions, and he feels okay, but could you feel the sort of the monotone and the bleakness, you know, but you can kind of get that vibe from him. That video also raises an important issue around always checking about people's suicidality, and this is something that you also want to be sure when assessing somebody to touch base about. And it's usually something that you're very naturally drawn to when you work with somebody who's presenting with depressive symptoms, that you always sort of say, you ever had thoughts about hurting yourself or wanting not to be alive? But it's something that you actually have to ask everybody. And it can really be a surprise sometimes, because people can present with a very chipper, you know, oh yeah, no, things are mostly fine, I'm just worried about this relationship. And then, you know, so in those situations, I usually say, you know, this probably sounds like kind of a question out of the blue, but there's something that's important for me to ask. Have you ever had thoughts about hurting yourself or wishing you weren't alive? And I've been surprised by how often people say, yeah, actually, I do think about that sometimes. And that really changes the whole nature of the assessment you're doing. In part because, obviously, the safety is the major thing you've got to protect before you do anything else. And so if somebody does indicate to you that they're thinking about killing themselves or they've had that thought, it's then really important to assess how real that threat is. And often if you say, you know, oh, that sounds like, you know, pretty serious. Is that something you thought that you really might do? Or is it something that just kind of goes through your mind and then you let it go? Often people say, oh, it's, you know, it's just a thought. It's like, I would never do it. Usually, and that's the response, and that's where they leave it. But sometimes they'll say, oh, no, it's something I think about sometimes. It's an option I consider. And then you sort of have to take it another step and you say, is this something that you've ever thought about having a plan for how you would do it? And sometimes people will get off the track there and they'll say, oh, you know, I mean, I kind of think about it, but I don't know how I would ever do it, you know, something I wouldn't do. And of course, as you're asking all these questions, it's a pretty anxiety-provoking situation, and so you sort of have to say, oh, okay, you know, but sometimes they say, no, my husband has a gun, and he keeps it in the garage, you know, and I know it's there, you know, and so then you have to sort of proceed and say, you know, do you have bullets for the gun? And, you know, this person says, no, we don't buy bullets, you know, that's, you know, you're sort of relieving, and she says, yeah, well, actually, I know we keep the bullets separate, but I know where they are. And so you can see how this really, you proceed down this line. And if it becomes clear through this line of questioning that there's a real risk that if this person leaves your office, that they're, you know, having talked about this a little bit, told somebody else, that they're going to think, you know, I can go through with that. You actually can't let them leave your office. You know, you have to say, this is really serious. It sounds like your safety is in question. We need to make a plan. And this, you know, can be a very awkward and difficult way to meet somebody and start a therapy, but obviously they've come for help, so you do all you can to help them. On a slightly lighter note, I had a really incredible experience with this when I was just starting out as a therapist, and I was meeting with a young woman who was very, very upset about a breakup, and so, you know, but she seemed very, you know, fine. I wasn't particularly worried about suicidality, but I asked anyway. You know, sometimes when people are this upset, they think about hurting themselves. Is this a thought you've ever had? And she says, no. She said, well, maybe a little bit. Sometimes, you know, when I'm really mad at my boyfriend, I feel like, you know, boy, I could make him pay. And so I say, you know, have you ever thought about how you would do something like this? She said, no, except for I am allergic to peanut butter. So if I ate peanut butter, that would kill me. And so then what's the question I have to ask next? Do you have any peanut butter? I have to ask this because it's her plan. And she says, oh, no, I don't buy peanut butter. You know? And so that was the end of it. But I thought, I never thought I would be asking for, like, do you have any peanut butter? So, okay. Line that up. Let's talk about psychological tests. So there's interviewing, which is my personal favorite way of trying to figure out what's going on. But there are also tests. And these can be used, obviously, in a broader sense. You can give the test to a lot of people at the same time. Sometimes they can be very helpful in trying to get a grip on specific issues that you're trying to assess. And when we talk about tests, we always have to talk about validity and reliability. And this is stuff that is probably familiar to you from introductory psychology. All these kinds of validity that you have here on your in your notes are fancy names for what is basically common sense. And since you've got the definitions right there, I'm going to go through this pretty fast and just give you examples. face validity is that you're giving a test that measures what it appears to measure. Basically, if you're doing a test of anxiety, you want your questions to look like they're anxiety questions. You want them to say things like, you know, do you ever feel panicked or nervous? Does your stomach ever feel upset? Do you ever have a hard time falling asleep? Right? Very sort of straightforward. Tests should be look like tests of what they are. Content validity starts to get more interesting. Basically, any phenomenon that we're trying to assess usually has several aspects involved. So to return to anxiety as an example, anxiety has cognitive components. You know, people are thinking about it. They're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get all my work done. This is terrible. You know, behind. It has physical components that people feel physically anxious. They may feel nauseous. They may feel sweaty. They may have headaches. Their heart may pound. It has emotional components, right, that they think they feel dread. They feel scared. They feel nervous all the time. And so a good test of something like anxiety is going to target all of those. And that's what content validity is. It asks about all of the content areas that are relevant to the thing you're trying to assess. So a bad test of anxiety would only say, does your heart pound sometimes? Do you break out in a sweat? Does your stomach feel bad? Right? Those are the times of physiological effects of anxiety, but that's not a really good anxiety test. A good anxiety test is going to ask about a lot more than that. Okay, concurrent validity. Does the test you're working with yield the same results as other established tests in that area? Okay. So say there is a fantastic anxiety test out there. It's been around for 50 years. It's really well done. It's really well validated. Everybody knows it's a good test. And we'll call it anxiety test number one. You give this anxiety test number one to an anxious person, and they score a 95, right, which on that test means really anxious. Say then I develop my own fancy new anxiety test number two, and I develop this, and I sit down, and I come up with a bunch of questions I think are good anxiety questions. And I give it to the same person who just got a 95 on the anxiety test number one. If that person on my test scores a 4 for anxiety on a scale of 100, I'm going to start to doubt the test I've just developed. A really good, solid test, anxiety test number one, this person's got a 95. On my test, they don't even show up as anxious, probably a problem with my test. So part of how we develop new tests is we make sure they match with the results of other good, old tests. If there's a good old test, you may be wondering why you need a new test. Sometimes you want to come up with a shorter form. Maybe the good old test has 150 questions and people don't like it, or they start to blow off the questions at the end of the form. So you need to come up with a smaller, more efficient one, but you want to know that it's at least as sturdy as the test that you are trying to replace. Predictive validity. If you have a test that you're using that's trying to predict behavior, you want to make sure that it actually predicts the behavior it says it's going to. IQ tests are a great example of this. The idea behind an IQ test is you've got somebody really smart, they should be going out and doing smart things, right? So if you continue to give IQ tests and get really high scores, but people don't seem to be able to perform well academically, they don't seem to be able to perform well in other areas, you start to wonder, if this is a measure of intelligence, how come it's not predicting to intelligent behavior? Are we actually measuring something other than intelligence here? Finally, there's construct validity. And this is probably the most complex one. Is the test measuring what it's supposed to measure, not something else? The absolute best example of this is probably the SAT. And a lot of people have had questions about the SAT and whether it's actually measuring, you know, school ability and intelligence, or if it's measuring multiple choice test-taking skill, right? Because people sort of have this idea that there's such a thing as skill at taking multiple choice tests. There's some people who don't perform very well on long written tests, but if you give them a multiple choice test, they're going to absolutely ace it. Also, as you, I'm sure, remember, the SAT takes a fair bit of endurance, right? You have to be patient, you have to be willing to sit there, you know, for hours filling out little bubble forms. And maybe that's a skill of its own. And so people have said, you know, a high SAT score may not be, you know, that this person is somehow brilliant. It may be that they're really, really patient, they're able to make good choices on multiple choice exams. And a low SAT score may not reflect poor school ability. It may reflect that this person is impatient or impulsive, or they choke when they get to a multiple choice test. And so that construct validity of the SAT has been called into question a lot. Okay, any question about those? Okay, let me move on to reliability then. And basically, reliability, the best way to think about it is test consistency. Meaning a test has to be able to give you consistent results across a variety of situations. One example of this is test retest reliability. If you give somebody a test and you come back to them 6 months later and give them the same test, are they going to get roughly the same score? You want them to do that. That would be good test retest reliability. What you don't want, you know, assuming you're testing a stable trait, what you don't want is to give somebody an IQ test 1 week and they get 140, and then you come back 6 months later and their IQ has dropped down to 100, right? That this is not something, we don't think IQ shifts around like that. So we think that test must not be so good if that's what's happening. Another thing is alternate form reliability, that there are times when people want to use two different forms of the same test. For example, you know, when I teach a large class, I'll usually generate a couple of different exams. Obviously, I want these exams to be consistent in terms of their difficulty of questions, the things on them, you know, to be fair to students. And so if I give one exam and, you know, 95% of the students who take that exam score in the 90% range and above, and then the other exam in 95% score in the 60% range or above, bad reliability, right? These are not reliable exams. They're not consistent with each other. Another version of that is that we have IQ tests for different ages. There's an IQ test for kids who are preschoolers, an IQ test for kids who are lower schoolers, and then there's one for middle schoolers, and then there's one for high schoolers and adults. And even though these are completely different tests, and they use very different methods for assessing little kids than you assess adults, they should all come up with roughly the same score if you test somebody across their lifetime. And I've been impressed, actually, the current IQ tests that we use actually do. I've done testings with high schoolers with their lower school IQ scores in front of me, and they usually come up with very similar results, which is a good, means the IQ tests are sturdy and well designed. Internal reliability. You want different parts of the same test to produce roughly the same results. Basically, this means that your questions are sort of even in their level of difficulty, even in terms of assessing roughly the same things. Another way of putting that, if I give an exam with 100 questions, I should be able to select 30 questions out of there, and the average of those should be very close to the average of the whole 100. But that really speaks to the stability and reliability of the test. Finally, there should be inter-rater or inter-judge reliability. If it's the kind of test that's done by observation, so say for an example, I've got a test of how well decorated somebody's home is, right? And I go in and I've got my little decorator home thing, and I score the person's home on that quality. Somebody should be able to take the same form I have and get roughly the same results. You know, the form should be designed well enough that two different people who fill out the same form on the same topic are going to come up with roughly the same results. Does that make sense? Okay. Moving on, there are lots of different kinds of tests for assessing psychopathology, and of course the issues of validity and reliability that I've talked about so far apply to all of these. First ones are biological tests. These are pretty incredible. And mostly we use these for looking at people where we think there is a brain disorder that is causing psychopathology. Obviously, we want to do this on a living subject. One of the problems with Alzheimer's is you actually cannot conclusively diagnose Alzheimer's until somebody has died, because you need to look at certain brain abnormalities. And right now, we have no way of looking at those brain abnormalities while the person is still alive. There are, however, a couple of unbelievably cool tests that you can use to look at somebody's brain while they're still alive and awake. One of them is an MRI. Has anybody ever had an MRI? Get them for knee surgeries and all sorts of things. The cool thing about MRIs is that they can actually take an x-ray of soft tissue. You know, before the MRI, you could only x-ray things that were hard, like bones. And MRIs actually use technology that allows doctors to look at soft tissue through skin. It's a pretty incredible thing. The same can be done to look at the structure of the brain, and look at how the brain is functioning, and you can basically take an x-ray of a brain. You can find out things like the presence of cancer, right? If somebody also has psychotic symptoms and you think maybe they have a tumor that is causing these, that's a very effective way to try to check. You can also look to see if the ventricles of their brain, which are the open spaces of their brain, are growing, which means their brain is shrinking, which is sometimes found in schizophrenia. These are all things you can do. I'll show you some pretty cool tape on this. Another, and I think these are absolutely unbelievable, are PET scans. I doubt anybody here has ever had a PET scan. A PET scan is a positron emission tomography, and this is in your textbook. And basically what happens is you go to the hospital to get this done, and you drink radioactive juice, Kool-Aid. They put radioactive, you know about this?
Because I had stretch fractures in my feet.
Oh, okay.
And it like shows up on the screen.
Yeah, it's this incredible thing. You drink, what was your drink like that you
had? It was kind of like Kool-Aid.
Uh-huh.
It was so weird, but it tasted good.
maybe you can get some for class. So they put radioactive isotopes in a liquid, and you drink them. The way it works in the brain, this is absolutely amazing. There is glucose in this radioactive isotope, and glucose is something your body metabolizes when it's metabolizing actively. They then give people mental tasks while they have their head in a CAT scan, something like a CAT scan machine. And when your brain is working, different parts of your brain work to do different tasks, but when your brain is working, it metabolizes glucose. And so in those areas that are metabolizing more glucose, you get a concentration of radioactivity. And basically, it looks like the weather charts when you're watching to see if a storm is coming through. You know how they get the radar, and they've got the, you know, the thunderstorms where there's the red, and then it goes from there. That's exactly what it looks like in the brain, and I'll show you that. And so you can really see if people's brains are working right by seeing which parts are using the most glucose at the right time, and if the right parts are using glucose at the right time. So this can be hugely helpful in not only looking at the physical structure of the brain, which is what the MRI can do, but in looking at the actual functioning of a living brain as it's actually functioning. Let me show you a couple of segments. They have, I think the second one shows a schizophrenic person who is supposed to be doing a task and the brain does not light up in the right ways, which is a hint as to what may happen in schizophrenia with brain processes. So PET scan, so it's positron emission tomography, and this is the radioactive isotope stuff.
So we have a normal subject here. Now what exactly are we doing?
Okay, well, he has been put in our single photon emission scanner and is at the moment performing, he's making key taps as you can see there, a task called the Wisconsin card sort. He's looking at the screen and seeing a number of perceptual figures that he has to try and decide how to sort out and press the right key. The rules are not given to him, all he's told is whether or not there's a right or a wrong. The screen flashes to indicate that. And what we're interested in doing is seeing what areas in the brain are activated by this type of task.
What you're going to be doing today, Dave, is a card sort, just like you've done before, okay? Not going to be any different.
This is the schizophrenic.
The exact same thing you've done before. You're fine. Lines on your face, I'll take those off and you're all done, so you won't go back looking funny.
So here we've got a patient undergoing the same test. Now, what would you expect to see then, if we were to look at the scan?
Right, well, what we'll see is that in the normal, we will have seen an increase in blood flow in the frontal lobe regions due to the task, due to the demands made by this task on the brain. The difference that we've seen between the schizophrenic and normal will be the result of his failure to activate that region. Which we think is what is necessary in order to do the task properly.
Ah, I see. And once again, the study of identical twins provides a more controlled basis for comparison.
Now these SPECT scans, this is actually a pair of our twins, and what they show is that when patients are engaged in a particular behavior that puts a premium on function from the prefrontal part of the brain, the affected twin shows consistently less activity in that part of the brain than does the healthy twin.
And is that accompanied also by a lower performance of the test?
Yes,
well?
It is. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Now, in this set of scans, the area of the brain that is activated by doing this particular task, which is the Wisconsin card sorting task, is this left prefrontal region of the brain over here.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can see is that this part of the brain is consistently more activated in this particular twin pair. This is a healthy twin.
Mm-hmm.
This twin shows this activation pattern in a way that is not seen in this twin, which is the unaffected.
So the red and orange patches are the activated parts.
Correct.
And these bluer and colder things are relatively inactive.
Correct.
It is quite conspicuous, the difference.
So now this is just looks at soft structure. It doesn't look at functioning. But this is the X-ray of soft tissue.
By bloodlessly sectioning the living brain, we now have the opportunity to see if Maudsley was right. These are the brains of identical twins, one normal, the other apparently suffering from schizophrenia.
I don't think you have to know anything about magnetic resonance imaging to recognize that these are not exactly the same brains, and that this scan, there are dark regions, the so-called spinal fluid spaces, are bigger in this patient, in this subject, which is the affected twin, than in this subject at exactly the same spot in the brain, and this is the healthy twin. And
so there's been brain shrinkage then of some sort?
Yeah, I think the assumption would be that there's some process, a pathological process, some disease process, that has affected this brain to produce a reduction in the overall volume of this brain, and that the inside of the head, which has not changed in volume,
mm-hmm.
now has greater spinal fluid spaces to make up for the loss of the volume of brain tissue.
I'm going to stop it there. Isn't that amazing? Thank you very much. We have an option right now. Do people want to take a 5-minute bathroom break? Why don't we do that? Just because this is a long 2-hour stretch. So the bathrooms are right there, or just get up and take a stretch, right next to the water fountains, and then we'll come back in 5 minutes. And by my watch, it's 5 minutes after 10 right now. So if people need to do that, please feel free.